Welcome to the first Flaneur podcast of 2015. This week we review Betty and Joan at the St. James Theatre, the new film Erebus, Into the Unknown, and Refraction, The Image of Sense, at Blaine Southern. The queue for the studio auditorium at the St. James Theatre included a chopsy old lady in a wheelchair. She muttered and chanted to herself and didn't have to show a ticket to be allowed in. She appeared to be a critical relative of one of the cast members, but when I saw her again, she was being lifted onto a central chaise longue. Betty Davis had arrived on stage. Betty and Joan, The Final Curtain, is a devised theatre piece originally created by Foresight Theatre, starring Sarah Thom as Betty Davis and Sarah Toogood as Joan Crawford. Much affection is obvious in the portrayals of these two Hollywood stars of Hollywood's golden age, renowned for their mutual dislike and feuding. Davis and Crawford only appeared together in one film, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, yet their names are forever linked together. The scene is Davis' deathbed in 1989. Her two Oscar statuettes are nearby, as is a framed picture of her beloved daughter, Beedie, and a secret stash of vodka. Her chosen reading is Mommy Dearest, the unsympathetic memoir by Joan Crawford's daughter, Christina. Across the room is a large wardrobe to be used as a screen for projections and also, a la C.S. Lewis, the portal into and out of the next world. Cher's If I Could Turn Back Time plays poignantly on the radio, giving way to a fun soundscape by Elena Bina. That Joan Crawford has been sent to fetch Betty Davis to heaven suggests that not everything we are to see is definitive fact, although writer James Greaves says only 5-10% of the script is invented. When Crawford arrives, Davis is inconveniently not actually dead, causing problems which are referred to a pair of Hollywood showbiz hacks who appear in video projection. Has she seen her life flash before her eyes, they ask, as though that is the only way to tell if someone is dying. She hasn't, but she starts to, and as her mind turns to her great rival, we are suddenly privy to episodes from their careers, their marriages, and are able to witness their feisty interactions. Built on thorough research, Betty and Joan is a delight for lovers of the actresses and their films. Aficionados will enjoy spotting quotations, wisecracks and props from movies. The two Sarahs have clearly spent hours studying their subjects, and they move with some of the rhythms of the Hollywood actresses, borrowing gestures that recall the two women. Davis and Crawford had a well-documented bad relationship, but this divide documentary points out the similarities in their lives. It even hints that, for them and us, under a difficult relationship, there may be a friendship worth pursuing. But there's a lot of squabbling, and even though Davis jokes and Crawford dances, it is a sad portrayal of lives which have descended into unhappiness and loneliness. Don't leave before the credits. Camping in Antarctica comes quite high on the list of things I don't want to do. This feeling would be even stronger if the campsite was on the edge of a plane crash site and I had to work 12-hour shifts every day for 2 weeks, finding and removing bodies and body parts. Such was the horrendous life-changing experience for 11 members of the New Zealand Police Force in 1979 that is retold in Erebus Into the Unknown. An Air New Zealand plane had gone missing in November during a sightseeing flight over Antarctica. The fate of the 257 passengers was soon discovered. The plane had flown directly into Mount Erebus, the highest mountain in Antarctica. With winter approaching, a team of ill-trained and badly equipped policemen were dispatched from Auckland to bring the bodies back. This was made clear to them. They were engaged in body retrieval, not investigation. Locate, identify, record, and bag. Directed by Charlotte Purdy, the film combines reconstructions with archive footage, photographs, and interviews with those involved. The youngest officer, Stuart Layton, recounts much of the story, and along with his colleagues, describes the horrors they encountered, including crevasses waiting to trap the unwary, and having to eat with the same gloves they used to move the bodies. The film heads in two directions, primarily showing the grotesque sights and experiences the men faced every day, and the effects these had on their subsequent lives. But there is also the suggestion that Air New Zealand was involved in a cover-up designed to shore up the company's reputation, with evidence going missing, and the chief executive authorizing the destruction of irrelevant documents. Of course, he was the one who defined irrelevant. The dramatized reconstructions in New Zealand have been given a suitably retro filter to conjure up the 70s feel of beige tank tops and grey suitcases. In comparison, the scenes in Antarctica are stunningly white and appear beautiful, until attention returns to the macabre task at hand. Shining light on a controversial subject, Erebus is only 67 minutes long and could have spent longer investigating the appearance of senior Air New Zealand staff at the crash site and the fate of some vital evidence. The police found the captain's notebook, yet it subsequently disappeared. Was the cause of the accident pilot error, or had the crew been given faulty information? The film spends longer with the investigators' stories and portrays professionals doing a deeply unpleasant job with determination. The first thing that hits you in Blaine Southern's new group show, as long as you've made it intact through the heavy door, is the annoying high-pitched whir of a detuned TV set. Room 1 of Refraction, The Image of Sense, is overwhelmed by a 1973 piece called Information that winds along for almost half an hour. By Bill Viola, it imparts little information, the screen being filled with hard-to-look-at electronic noise. It deliberately ruins the contemplative gallery atmosphere and makes you appreciate afresh the few seconds of silence when it is preparing to loop again. As it is so unpleasant to the human eye, a large part of what the viewer ends up focusing on is the Sony logo at the bottom of the screen. This is the main take-home point from the piece. Bill Viola must recommend Sony. Michael Manning's Pineapple and Red Cabbage Coleslaw is another electronic work, a large-scale screensaver in neon colours. On a large rectangular LCD wall screen, its abstract image changes slowly. It might be changing randomly or looping, the moment of greatest interest being when the message, "The audio data is not supported," flashes up on screen, but that might not be intentional. One visitor stared at it and then said, "Oh, Samsung." I doubt that was Manning's intention, but she'd obviously spent too long in front of the Bill Viola piece. Across the room, a series of prints by Lars Holdus lines one wall. The names are one long list of characters, such as D51, D9A, 3A1, A2, B8, BE, 166, D22, E705, D51, D0, D9, DE, 49E, 29A, 2DAF, 163, 16, ED, 170, B96, B0, A4F. The significance of this naming system is hidden. The images themselves, repetitive black and grey lists and diagrams of numbers, and occasional faces that don't make the viewer want to investigate further. In the second room, Elias Hansen has wired up some coloured light bulbs and dangled them amidst poorly made wooden shelves, nude playing cards, glass beakers and general tat. Looking like the laboratory for a low-budget Nutty Professor remake, the piece is called Love Really Had a Way of Letting Us Lose Ourselves. Bearing in mind Connolly's observation that there is no more sombre enemy of good art than the pram in the hall, the implication is that love made me do it. Curated by Peter J. Amdam, this is the sort of exhibition where a girl sitting next to the wall tapping on a tablet might be a gallery assistant, but also could be one of the works. It's not a show to worry if you miss. Thanks for listening. You can find more reviews online at www.flaneur.london. See you next time.